Hello, and welcome to the Advent AM podcast, Risk and Business. Today, I'm joined by two esteemed colleagues, by James Morris, who is the director at the CSBR Policy Centre. Hi, James.
Hiya.
And Malcolm Waugh, who is chair of CNI Scotland. Hi, Malcolm.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking all things CNI, the critical national infrastructure, and cyber threats, and maybe have a little bit of a look at what future state might be looking at. There's legislation to discuss, there's events coming up to discuss, and a whole range of other things. So with no further delay, let's get into it. So hi, Malcolm, first, of course, and I'm delighted to say I'll be joining you up in Scotland in just a couple of weeks for the CNI Scotland event. So maybe this is a good point to start, is the term CNI. When we use the term CNI, critical national infrastructure, what do we really mean by that?
Well, it's one of the problems, of course. If you go to seven different countries, you get seven different determinations of what it means. So I look upon it as the fabric that keeps society going. So the infrastructure that keeps society going. That's generically meant because increasingly we find there are other periphery types of infrastructure. Undersea warfare, undersea, for example, is one at the moment, which are really part of our critical national infrastructure, but don't feature in the structure as it stands at the moment.
Yeah, there's been a lot in the news recently about undersea cables and the threat from hostile nation states and stuff like that. James, you obviously focus there on cybersecurity and business resilience, and we've made that emphasis before. Of course, CNI underpins a lot of other businesses as well, not just in terms of citizens.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, our definition of CNI has to evolve and has evolved, hasn't it? I mean, if you look at the recent example of the JLR shutdown, now, you know, a company like JLR employing, as it does, you know, thousands of people, a very integrated supply chain, you know, the implications of JLR not being able to function, you know, you could argue is an example of the breakdown of critical national infrastructure. In a digital economy, even if you're making cars, the integration of the digital elements of what JLR were doing means that, you know, we should be viewing CNI and critical national infrastructure as being our economic relations in that sense. When you see the impact, as you were describing, the kind of the actors that are involved here, this kind of merging and blurring of the lines between nation state actors who want to undermine the UK. I mean, you know, whether or not it was a hostile actor that got into JLR's infrastructure, we don't actually really know. I mean, we can surmise it may well have been, and you know, there is a lot of evidence that those aspects of our infrastructure and at the heart of our economic life are being targeted. So the whole definition of what we mean by CNI is changing before our eyes in that sense.
I mean, we both come from the Midlands, actually, so we know about Jaguar Land Rover. Over 5,000 smaller businesses have been affected by that shutdown. Now, they're the ones that don't hold the money. So some of those are going to go out of business. And one of the things we don't talk about in CNI, who owns it? I mean, if you look at the maritime CNI, much of it is owned by China, or at least run by China. They run 127 different ports around the world, and somewhere in the region of about 60-70% of our container traffic goes through ports which they own. So it's a multi-layered issue, and the danger sometimes is that we look at it too simplistically, but then we make it complicated so people don't understand it. So there's quite a lot going on in that area which we need to sort of unfocus and get our minds around, I think.
Yeah, we did discuss this a few years back, James, the fact that CNI, a huge amount of CNI is not in public ownership, it's in private ownership, and a lot of that private ownership is not UK ownership. So the UK national interest, and you know, we talk about a lot about sort of sovereignty, whether it's data sovereignty or infrastructure sovereignty. Actually, that's very difficult to guarantee, isn't it, with so much foreign ownership and banking, infrastructure, transport, manufacturing. You know, we think of JLR as being a huge British brand, of course, but it's not UK owned anymore.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a highly, I mean, you know, it revealed the, you know, the double-edged sword of globalization. I mean, you know, the impact, JLR is a very efficient company using just-in-time, you know, delivery. It's our IT is largely outsourced, I would surmise. And, you know, that does create complexity and difficulty in terms of the management of it. But I suppose, you know, that leads to a discussion about how you regulate and how you can create more transparency along those supply chains, among all of those different players in the picture. It speaks to wanting to get, you know, regulation right and legislation right. And that's why we've been doing a lot of work around the Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill. What we know about the way that the government is thinking about that is that they are looking at a broader definition of critical national infrastructure, talking about data centers obviously becoming, you know, into the ambit of that legislation, and then looking for ways of getting better international cooperation and better international standards and protocols around security and CNI. So trying to get all of that stuff right, I think, is really important, but it doesn't take away the issue that you've raised, which is that that isn't easy, it's complicated, and there's a lot of potential weak nodes that can be exploited by our adversaries.
I mean, I think there are two problems as well. I mean, regulation has to be done, but until you convince boards that this is a critical part of their business, which many of them don't see it yet, then you're stuck. I'm not going to comment particularly on Jaguar, although I have had a briefing on it. People tend to ignore this problem until it hits them in the backside. And we've got to get across that actually this is not only important for their business, but in the case of Jaguar Land Rover, it's important for very much smaller businesses. And they need to have some responsibility for that.
Yeah, absolutely. The ripple throughout the supply chain has been phenomenal. And then the statistic I saw was that it cut UK car production by 27%. We're talking at a bill of, you know, up to £2 billion already, a supply chain that was thoroughly disrupted, some suppliers on the edge of going out of business. And that's just one incident.
But then you look abroad and you look at AWS, and you see the chaos that created. Partly because not many people really understood what AWS was providing them for a service. So it's a bit like the supply chain problem. We don't map it because it's so complicated. So what we need to look at are some priorities, nodal points, if you like, where we can actually make sure that they're correct, right, and proper, and take it from there rather than do an omni approach, which tends to confuse people and doesn't get done.
Yeah, this is something we've talked about at the CSBR a number of times, James. So the complication that comes through, and we say the term supply chain, but really it's a supply ecosystem. And there was a Guardian article I read that said nearly a third of bosses have reported increases in cyber attacks on their supply chains, as opposed to directly on their organizations now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, two things came to my mind when Malcolm was talking. One of which, and again, the JLR situation has kind of brought this into sharp relief, which is what is the role or otherwise of government when a large piece of our national infrastructure, whether that's a company or whatever, suffers a problem? Because the government decided that it would stand behind a loan in order to make sure that JLR was able to continue functioning and be able to pay its supply chain. Now that's a slightly different, that was a slightly different response, but yet it does raise questions about what the role of government is when a part of our infrastructure gets paralyzed, particularly when it's a private company You know, it's probably got quite a lot of cash in the bank, might not have insured itself properly, because you get into the whole area of kind of moral hazard. So I don't necessarily have a direct answer to it, but there is a question about what is the role of government in the situation where, you know, our economic infrastructure is coming under attack. Does government have a role inevitably or not? And the other thing that, you know, from a very practical point of view, the other thing about the JLR situation was that, you know, I think it's important that when companies are thinking about security and resilience, they might not want to have their IT outsource company doing cybersecurity as well as everything else that they do, because you get some kind of difficult conflict of interest there. And actually what you want is to have a pure play a cybersecurity outfit, perhaps, that is doing that specifically, because I think there's dangers when you've got a big outsourced player that's trying to do everything, because it creates multiple levels of additional vulnerability, especially with a global footprint. I mean, I'm not pointing the finger specifically at anybody.
Even more extreme example, which of course is the offshore network infrastructure, much of which is outside national territory. So who polices that? Who owns it? Now, in most cases, guess what? The Chinese have a controlling interest in much of our infrastructure that goes across the Atlantic. And yet over 90% of our data goes across the Atlantic because it's held in data centers in America. So again, what we've not done is we've not made the connections, which are important. We've not prioritized, as it were, the vulnerabilities we need to look at. And one of the problems we arises from that is we get too much information about this thrown at us. So you ask the average person in the street, what is CNI? How do I protect themselves? They go, oh my God, not another bit of verbal diarrhea. So we have to try and keep it simple for the majority of people. That's the message I'm trying to get across.
And of course, we've seen the implications here in the UK on supply chain attacks with the NHS and the disruption that has caused, and the implications it's made on people's healthcare, and in some cases, you know, threat of life as a result of services not being able to function.
I think that brings into another point, which you've got. I actually did some investigation into one of the National Health Service, and it was very siloed in where they were thinking. Now, if you take out the National Health Service or part of it, you're affecting a vast majority of the population and other parts of the empire. The rail network might be affected because people can't get to work because they're sick. And what we're not very good at is this cross-pollination, if you like, is realizing it's not just a vertical problem, it's a horizontal problem.
It's back to the point that I've made several times, which is, it's interesting, like Mark, talking about people's perception of what they think critical national infrastructure. If you were to, you know, you talk to people in the street about what they think the definition might be, you know, they probably think that there's still quite a, you know, we're all talking in quite technical language and so on and so forth. And I think there's still, and this is absolutely essential to the future, which is being. And I think organizations are beginning to understand this. You know, National Cybersecurity Center, even our intelligence services and the government are being a lot more open in that sense about the nature of the threat which the UK faces and the threat that UK citizens face. And it is becoming more concrete daily in the public mind, I think. You know, I think we're going through a real transition. Where the lead story on the BBC is about cybersecurity and about, you know, what's been happening. And that is beginning to have an effect on public perceptions, which I think is probably positive, even though the things that are happening aren't great, but it is a positive catalyst.
As you know, Ollie Whitehouse, the CTO at NCSC, has said, we've got to stop talking, we've got to start delivering. And that's really the big equation, is what do we have to deliver to make sure we're protected? What do we have to deliver to make sure that we don't wait until we're attacked? We do something beforehand. So I'm actually with him in the way that they're going about that. Let's get some delivery into process and let's get that working properly.
But I think you need absolutely agree. You need to have the delivery And that is a kind of multi-layered thing, all kinds of different things we need. But you also need to have this kind of societal buy-in to the fact that this is necessary, urgent, and if we don't get it right collectively, we're going to be in real trouble. And I don't think we're quite there yet with that part of the equation. You know, we know what needs to be done from a kind of hardening point of view, but that's only part of the struggle, or part of the challenge, rather, in my mind.
I'm often a very naughty boy, so I went into our local supermarket, who I won't name, and said, "What happens if the till stop working?" And I got a blank look, and I actually know the manager in there vaguely, or the manager of the day, and I said, "What happens if the till stop working?" And this is the problem, is people don't think the consequences of what might happen in their local environment and what they then must do about it.
Yeah. Well, I live in a rural community, and I've never heard the word cyber uttered so many times by so many people as I did after the attack on the Co-op, which is our local grocery supplier in and around Weardale. So I think it certainly became a societal impact that made people much more aware. Of course, it's not just an ephemeral cyber problem. We've got attacks on our physical infrastructure. Malcolm mentioned offshore energy, undersea cables. You know, the threat to UK PLC is very real and very now, isn't it?
But can I give you a couple of quick stories which slightly illustrate common sense and what can take place? The first one's quite simple. It's a super yacht. And it just so happens I had one of my guys to go and look at this super yacht, which was owned by a super person. And guess what? All the passwords for all the critical equipment were actually just on the machinery. So he phoned me up and I said, what should I do about it? And I said, just take it all off. And it actually achieved the right result, because the guy who owned the yacht suddenly found out, which he hadn't really realized, that actually he had a problem. So sometimes you have to be pretty, as it were, simplistic in your approach, and it has to be done quite quickly to see the effect. And the other one was, I quite like this one very quickly. I was in a nuclear submarine fire a long time ago, and the guys who got their Queen's Gallantry Medal applied common sense to the situation. They were well trained, but they didn't necessarily follow the full procedure. They saw the situation as it stood at the time and did the right thing, thank goodness. Otherwise, we could be in real trouble. And the last bit of that is that when you do get into these crises, it's amazing how people do rise to the occasion. But in order for that to happen, they have to have some confidence. In order for that to happen, they have to have had some education and training. So I think there's lessons around all of that, which we can promulgate, I think, a bit more than we do at the moment.
I think part of it is getting security, and I'm going to use the term security rather than cybersecurity, because I think we, funny enough, have been having this back and forth with a few people on LinkedIn recently, because all of a sudden the term convergence has popped up again. And I've been saying, well, convergence isn't something that's happening. It's something that happened. Cyber-physical came and happened, and we have to catch up with that. You know, the interconnectedness of everything means that our physical world and the online world have become indelibly linked with each other. So we have to think in a much more holistic manner, much more joined up manner. And as you've made the point there, Malcolm, across industry, across government, across society, we need to have a much bigger picture. But also, I think it's time that we really went back to the design phase and said, we now need to get all of these disciplines working collaboratively as an individual security team rather than separate silos. And I think that's where things like Secure by Design are starting to make an impact, because it really is saying, actually, there is no cyber, there is no physical, there is no people security, it's security. And we need a multidisciplinary, multifaceted approach to that. What do you think to that?
Well, I'm very keen on training, as it were, and I think that's part and parcel of the issue, education and training, if I take that logic. And I'm a great believer in exercising as well, because if you exercise something, the better people realise what they don't know and learn from it. And they also, people start to work as a team. So I would advocate, actually, that even 6 and 7 year olds should get some basic education in what happens if there is a CNI attack in the broad way we've described it. And you take that through life. And I've got one other quick pitch, which I'm not certain Tony Hall would have enjoyed, but anyway, I'll go for it. Why doesn't the BBC do what it did in the Second World War and broadcast some very simple examples of what we need to do when we have a problem? I mean, it would be really helpful. And they might be have to be repeated a lot, but that would at least get the message across to people that we are in a bit of a crisis here.
But that's an interesting point Michael makes, because I often track stories, and you know, suddenly we have been seeing on the main BBC website an article saying, you know, cybersecurity, what does it mean, and what does it mean for you in response to quite a lot of these things that have been going on. So you, this is the point I was making. You are seeing a kind of a bit more, a bit of a change in the public media discourse, which is in response to some of these events, and actually I think is quite helpful. And the other thing that I was thinking, again, with my sort of policy, with the policy hat on, is that, you know, the point you're making, Mike, about how this interconnection, this blurring of the lines between national security and individual company level security or even infrastructure security, and how it's impacting on thinking about policy. Because in the Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill policy statement, it talks a lot about aligning us with NIS regulations, but only up to a point, and makes the point that, you know, there are specific security issues the UK faces that the legislation needs to respond to. And, you know, we should be seeing this whole piece as being about national security, really. That's the shift that's occurred. And the legislation needs to reflect that a lot more. And the government effort needs to reflect that a lot more, in terms of this kind of redefinition. That what we're talking about here is threats to our national security in the sort of terms that we would normally talk about national security, which, you know, an existential threat to the UK sovereignty from hostile actors who want to do damage to us, as opposed to, you know, criminals doing stuff. They're going to do that, but the picture has become a lot bigger and a lot more complicated.
Can I ask you a question, James? Because I know you're an expert on the bill, and I'm not, although I have read it. Will Parliament be flexible and dynamic? Because quite often we produce a bill, put a lot of effort into the bill, but we're in a very dynamic situation in this area of cyber. And I do wonder that sometimes the legislation will then either lapse because it's become out of date, or it won't be updated sufficient to keep up with the current trends. Is that an issue?
I think that's a major issue. I mean, you know, it takes 18 months to 2 years to get a piece of legislation through Parliament. This bill was promised back in July. I think there was a speech made by a minister a couple of weeks ago with the immortal phrase that the bill would be brought forward when parliamentary time allows, which is a kind of a way of saying it may happen tomorrow, but it might not be for several months. And, you know, it may be for very good reasons that the bill, you know, hasn't landed yet, because of these events that are going on around us. It's magnifying precisely the point that you're making, which is, you know, this legislation might be out of date before we've even got it on the statute book. And actually, one, you know, I'm not necessarily saying I agree with this, but I put it out there, which is, the effort required to put together legislation and put together a bill and do all of those things might be better spent actually doing the sorts of things that we're talking about today, which are, you know, the technical stuff that we need to do, telling businesses what they need to do, getting citizens on board. And actually, maybe the legislation is either not required or could do with being slimmed down. Because the tendency of government of whatever stripes is to try and solve everything within a piece of legislation, and it often results in very top-down approaches and so on. And I can sort of see this in this process that we're going through with this bill at the moment. And I'm a bit worried about that, because I'm a bit concerned that actually it might not it might not actually solve some of the problems that we have. It might sound as if it's going to, but in practice, it might not.
I have said this many times over the years that I genuinely don't believe that legislation, let alone regulation, can keep pace with threat. And maybe we need an alternative approach now to legislation and regulation to get businesses to step up and start taking this seriously and playing their part seriously. Because actually, the threat of punishment, the threat of prosecution, we've seen it with GDPR. You know, the fines for data protection breaches have increased. You know, from £5,000 to almost unlimited fines, and yet we're still seeing culturally within organizations that same stasis. So maybe we need to break the culture, and maybe legislation is the rather over-wieldy sledgehammer that isn't going to crack the nuts that we need it to crack.
I think that's right. Another quick illustration. I'm slightly careful because I haven't asked her about it yet, but we'll go for it. I have a brother who's in a care home, and when you ask the care home about CNI, they have blank faces, and ask about cyber, and it's not my problem. Well, of course, it is their problem because I've discussed it. And what the team at Strathclyde did 2 or 3 years ago is use cartoons to show people who are not technically savvy, not necessarily fully engaged in the sorts of discussions we're having right now, but need to understand what's going on. So communication can go on in several different ways. And one way is to do it quite simply, have some powerful background to it, but make sure that people can engage at a level that they understand. And we're not that good at doing that, I'm afraid.
It's interesting you mentioned about the BBC, and you mentioned during the Second World War, but of course, I can remember even into my childhood, Charlie Says, Meet Mike, He Swims Like a Fish, and, you know, all of these were very powerful public broadcasts that were designed to shape public safety, clunk, click. And that whole idea of public broadcasting, public education seems to have gone a little bit by the wayside. And maybe, you know, we do need a modern version of that. And I know what you're saying, James, that some of this stuff is now starting to come through on the BBC News website, but it's new rather than mainstream. And if we're going to change culture and behaviours and attitudes, and Malcolm's used the term education, education is as much about changing behaviours as it is about facts and figures. So maybe we need a different approach now to changing the culture at a business level, but also at an individual responsibility level.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that would be that fits into this absolute necessity to get a citizen and individual buy-in and business buy-in into what's actually happening. This is not, you know, what came to my mind actually when you were talking about, you know, there's public information films in the 80s about, you know, the reality of what would happen if a nuclear bomb dropped on us, you know, and you know, I'm not saying we need to be that over dramatic or whatever, but, you know, the geopolitical environment we're in, you know, we're talking about a situation where, you know, penetration of our digital defenses we're involved in a proxy global conflict here, and it's kind of happening. We're not calling it that, but it's happening. And one of the issues that we have also is that there's a lot of disinformation. You know, not only do we have security threats, but we have disinformation threats. We have threats to our democratic way of life, and we have a sense of society being fragmented, which is not helping us get this kind of coherent narrative out about the threat that we're facing, because it's almost like we're living in an age of fragmentation. We're living in an age where people don't know what to believe. And this kind of lack of a shared sort of sense of shared cohesive values. I know that's a bit philosophical from what we've been talking about, but the reason I raise it is because if you want to have societal purpose, you've got to have a sense of sort of shared values. And at the moment, we don't really have that. It's almost like there's quite a passivity around about what's going on. because it's not some, you know, if there's a terrorist attack, it's visible, and we understand that, but we're not quite in the same place when it comes to the kind of the hidden threats that then suddenly manifest themselves in collapse of infrastructure or car firms shutting down.
And I think we can learn from other people. We tend to be quite insular in how we go about it. I mean, I've been talking to quite a few Ukrainians, reasons I won't bore you with, and people who've been into Ukraine, and also the Scandinavian states, Estonia particularly, where they've developed an approach which has the whole population involved, if you like, in their defence. It's called total defence in the case of the three states up there. And you get a sense of cohesion in their society. You get a sense everybody's trying to work together. Everybody understands there's an issue here, which you don't really get in Britain. I don't get that anywhere. You may, but, you know, it's going to happen tomorrow, but it's not going to concern me is the sort of approach I tend to hear from.
Yeah, and maybe we need to also rethink the language that we use when we're talking about cyber, because if we have an organization that's hit and the systems are encrypted and we see it on the news and we say, oh, it's ransomware and they're after cryptocurrency, and it all feels very divorced from real life. If we say, actually, here is a criminal gang who have attacked an organization and now they are extorting them through blackmail for financial gain. And actually, I was interested to see the kickback, the public kickback with that nursery attack recently. And in fact, from what I've read, the attackers backed right off and said, oh, yeah, no, we hear what people have said. We're not going to demand the money after all. But, you know, I think if we change the language and make it more personalized and more real life, and, you know, that when somebody breaks into the Louvre and steals a whole load of jewels, it feels very real. But when they break into a bank and walk away with cryptocurrency, everybody goes, no idea what that's all about.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a very important point. I mean, you know, to make it more concrete.
There's a good phrase called keep it simple, stupid, and I rather support that, Kiss, because we so often complicate it. The technical people understand what they're trying to achieve. And I'm getting really fed up with the acronyms that are often used, because they're often preaching to themselves and not to the audience who need to understand it. So keeping a simple approach, but accepting that's a lot much more complicated behind that, I think is really important.
So, of course, artificial intelligence is going to fix all of this for us, isn't it?
Of course, of course. But it's obviously it's presenting a whole new an understanding of the threat landscape. It's going to raise all kinds of issues again about, you know, as Mike and you and I have discussed, about its impact on the health service if we're starting to use it there, about trust, data privacy, and so on. So it's got the potential to be transformative, as we've spoken before. But in terms of this issue about societal trust and how we can use it to our advantage, I think that's where the big moot point is, isn't it? Which is, you know, it's a kind of two contrasting visions of the future. One of which is pretty dark, and where, you know, things are out of control, and we have all kinds of things crawling around the world and in our digital networks, which we can't control. Or, you know, it's relatively benign. We can trust it, and it helps us to deal with some of the bad guys, to put it in very simplistic terms.
It's not our first rodeo, though, is it? You know, we've been through this technology transformation a number of times in the last 30 or so years. Isn't it really important that once and for all, we really learn the lessons of the past, and then we move with this new technology in a much more controlled and knowing and properly risk managed, with the right governance wrapped around it, rather than leaping into yet another wholesale technological adoption and then trying to unpick the genies further down the line?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real big thing for me. I mean, if you plough back through history, clearly it might not have been cyber, but there are so many lessons we could learn. And okay, the language is slightly different, and the way it's used is slightly different. But if you get under the skin of it, you find that actually there's some really good lessons about how we operate as a population, how we respond individually, what happens when things go wrong, and so on and so forth, all of which are relevant in the digital society. The problem is many young people don't see it that way. You know, they're pioneers in this new vision of everything has to have ones and zeros in it. So it's another part of the educational process to ensure that people do understand we can learn lessons from history.
You know, it's interesting, actually, that among young people, when I talk to my son and to some of his friends, they're quite questioning about what's happening around at the moment. They're not just absorbing it and accepting it. There is more questioning among young people than you would imagine. I don't know whether that's your experience in terms of not just having this kind of passive acceptance that somehow, you know, we're living in a system which is out of control and we're all going to lose our jobs to AI and, you know, everybody's just going to be dancing to music that was created by an AI, whatever. And it's some sort of rather existential view of the future. There is a real sense of wanting to have more agency in this argument, which I find quite encouraging, actually.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. I mean, I think with certain people and young people, there's a thirst for new knowledge. But that isn't always how they've been brought up to do that. Sometimes you have to listen to people way outside your immediate environment who actually will offer you a slightly different solution. That's something I think you find as you get older. And if we can just get that across a bit more to younger people, particularly the bright younger people who are going to, you know, be the leaders of the future, that would be very beneficial, I think.
Yeah, I think I went through a brief period where I felt quite despairing that as a society we were losing the skill of critical thinking. But I am seeing more of that coming back around again now and more questioning. And I think you're right, James. I think there is a generation coming through who are questioning and who are exploring.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And that's encouraging in terms of some of the discussions that we're having about people having more agency and feeling as though they can actually influence and not just accept all of the things that are happening. And it's also a very digital savvy generation. So if we can try and convert people into being more positive and engaged, that's going to help us in some of the bigger, wider geopolitical battles that are currently underway. You know, and you know, young people have got a real sense of a fragmented and unstable world. I mean, they probably haven't really known a different situation, you know, but there's a real sense that we're living through this period of real instability, and they want to understand what it's all about.
Certainly the level of conflict in our backyard in Europe and about, you know, Ukraine and the Middle East, really. But we as a generation grew up in a peaceful world where largely there have been individual conflicts over time, but the idea that that could spill out into wholesale war has been very far from the near future for many of us, and suddenly there it is in our gardens all over again.
Can I name drop? If just one, I happened to have a discussion with Sir Jeremy Hunt the other day because he was in Scotland, and he really gave a very positive picture to quite a few of us in the audience, and we're not positive enough. In so many ways, there are all sorts of facts and statistics he was coming out with, which Britain is doing actually quite well at. But if you read the press, it's all terribly pressing. So I suppose the other side of the argument is let's promote ourselves in a way which is inspiring for the average person, which means they will do more and probably help themselves better. It's another part of the culture psychology that we're not quite attuned to, I think.
That's an interesting point, Malcolm. So thinking then to the future, what should organisations be thinking of? How should they be preparing? What are the key areas that they should be investing in now? You know, I mean, we've talked about education, training, education awareness, I think comes up time and time and time again, and yet continues to be massively underfunded in many organisations. But beyond that, what should they be considering as a key tool to protect themselves in the future?
Well, I think there's just on. I think if you take, I think companies, large and small, I think the need, and I think beginning to see it, where you have simulations of situations, so that boards get a real feel for different kinds of scenarios that might play out in real time, and how that might affect their business and how they deal with the crisis. Because, you know, with it, it's both a technical issue to understand what's actually happened, but the bigger fallout is actually reputational, it's risk, it's, you know, my falling market capitalization, what do I say to the markets, what do I say to my key stakeholders, and sort of having all of that as part of some kind of immersive experience for a board is something that I've been thinking about a lot, because I think the more real time that you can make it, the more real you can make it, make it about how, what sort of decisions are required. You know, what am I going to say when a reporter puts a camera in my face about, you know, what's happened to your company? All those sorts of things, I think, are of critical importance.
It's interesting that, James, because recently we were working with a client where we were role playing as part of their resilience planning. And one of the scenarios we role played was a major Microsoft 365 outage, only for a week later for Microsoft to have their little glitch. So that was really useful, because we're able then to have a follow-up with the board and say, aha. And now I can't take any credit for that. I had no forewarning or knowledge that was going to happen, but it was very useful. And of course, Malcolm, you mentioned AWS earlier, but you know, the unintended consequences, the number of organizations who themselves don't realize the level of reliance they've got on, you know, timesheet systems and financial organizations, and you know, the fact that one glitch over on the coast of America can have a global impact is something that we don't sometimes just don't consider.
I'm a big supporter of simulation, actually, for a whole variety, and my interest goes back 20 or 30 years for precisely the reasons that James has mentioned, and I sort of hinted at earlier, is that you can practice things in a safe environment. But all sorts of things come out of the woodwork, and usually they're very useful things that come out of the woodwork. So, and particularly at board level, who often are isolated, as they see it, from these everyday practicalities. So I'll name drop again, but I'm a big supporter of Cyber Ship Lab, for example, down in Plymouth, who do some excellent work in regard to what could you do if your ship had a problem approach. And we need to do more of that, and it needs to be joined up with the educational element, and then checking what people do, but checking what people have done on a practical basis, rather than necessarily coming in and dictating what they should do. What have they done that's done well? What have they not done so well? How can we help improve matters in the future?
And I think there needs to be a closing of the loop, if you like, with education, of measuring that education has resulted in a change, and not just be on permanent send. In terms of, obviously, just a quick future look, I mean, I can remember only a few short years ago when the conference season pretty much span up late spring and was done by late summer, and here we are going into November and we still have events on the horizon. Malcolm, the CNI Scotland event, would you like to say a little bit about what's going to happen up in Scotland in a couple of weeks?
Well, assuming the weather doesn't deter us, because the forecast is snow, but maybe not, is Scotland is actually a pretty important part of the United Kingdom, in my view, even if some people don't think that way. So the team that I'm looking after are all Scottish-based, but are internationally in the way their mindset is set. So one of the things I'm going to do is have a debate with people in Scotland exactly about this. What do we need to do in the future? What have we not done so well in the past? And hopefully drive a bit of innovation in it. And central to that is risk, which we haven't talked about yet. I see so many risk registers, which are a mathematical exercise to keep somebody happy, as distinct from what is the real risk. So that will be a central plank of the session in the afternoon. But I'm hoping people from all sorts of backgrounds come along, because it's designed to ask questions and hopefully get some answers from people like you. and other experts who are attending.
And registrations are open for that now, aren't they? So people can go and register for that. Okay. And I will be watching the weather with interest, because I will be journeying up to Scotland for that event from Farnborough, where I'm also participating in this year's JOSCAR Live. JOSCAR, of course, very much defence focused, but representing the supply chain into defence and helping to improve standards across the supply chain. So a lot of relevance there in what we've just discussed.
Well, I'm hoping I can learn something from the day, because shortly afterwards, I'm giving a board presentation with some people to quite a well-known and quite important engineering business in Scotland. And like everything, you go along to these events and you suddenly get somebody who tells you something. Oh, why did I not think of that? So I'm certain I'll learn something from the occasion as well.
And James, you've got another webinar coming up.
Yeah, we're doing a series of webinars. Yeah, we did one on Aon Healthcare, and we've got one coming on the 5th of November, which again is looking at the Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill. Not sure whether we'll have a published bill by then, but we're going to continue the discussion about along the lines of what we've been talking about today, about what we think should be in the legislation, the purpose of the legislation, and what else that we need to do, because we want to keep that debate going ahead of the bill. And so we're going to have another webinar on that.
Excellent. And, you know, I want to finish off, actually, and it's a great point there from Malcolm, by talking about risk. Like Malcolm, I've seen some great risk registers, some of them almost a work of art, that aren't necessarily helping organisations to manage risk. And I think front and centre getting this right going forward has to be more about managing risk and helping boards to understand risk. Again, language very important here, rather than technical jargon. I think we need to turn cyber risk and security risk and terrorist risk and all of these security risks that we're all very good at managing individually into something that is very pertinent as a business risk. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And probably my last point on this, again, I'm being slightly evasive, but I'll go for it, is that there's a physical risk quite often associated with the cyber risk. You know, infrastructures have boundaries around them, and those boundaries may well be penetrated by adversaries who also want to attack them digitally. And we're not very good yet at combining those two functions, looking at the whole site and saying to itself, what is the real problem here? What is the real risk in this place? What do we need to look after in the future?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. It's, again, part of the ongoing conversation that I've been having around convergence is we need to get past a debate about whether convergence is happening. Cyber-physical has happened. The worlds have joined up. We need to understand the impact that failures in physical security can enable cyber risk, and failures in cybersecurity can enable physical risk, and they need to be much more joined up and holistic. So, obviously, we're not going to solve this in one sitting, and I'm sure there will be plenty of opportunities for us to get back together and have more discussion around this. Let's finish by, if there's one thing that you would ask business leaders to prioritise in 2026, what would it be? James first.
Well, I think it's the ensuring that my cybersecurity and business risk is front and centre of the agenda in terms of thinking about my strategy and thinking about my risks. I think and then having those plans in place and having that kind of real-time understanding of the threat that my business has got, you know, on a day-to-day basis. Because to your point about risk, these things aren't static. You know, your risk is something that's constantly adjusting and changing, you know, sometimes almost by the hour. So that kind of flexibility and understanding and socializing it all into my business, I think is critical to where we need to go.
That's great. Malcolm.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, quick phrase, get out and find out. So often boards don't do that. they sit in there, and I've been there, so I know, they've been in their ivory towers. They don't really find out what is going on down below in their companies, and they need to do that, particularly in this area, which is so fast moving and can be so vulnerable for them. So again, I agree with what James has just said.
And I think that is a two-way street. I think people in security need to get out and find out and spend more time with their business communities and their business leaders, and spend time asking the business leaders what's important to them as well. And I like what you said there, James, about just in time. For me, once and for all, I'd like to see a break from the age-old convention of doing security once a year.
absolutely right.
Perhaps we need to invent a new term that always inspires some people. Then they can produce all sorts of new consultancies based on the new term. But
I mean, I very much like the language that's being used in Secure by Design about continuous assurance, continuous risk management, continuous. I think the idea that you can manage risk once a year, that you can penetration test your systems once a year, that you can do education once a year, is so old-fashioned as to...
There's an extra word to put into that, which is feedback. Continuous, yes, but feedback. So you learn all the time in what is a very reactive situation.
They are continuous, timely, with feedback. I think we may just have come up with the solution there, guys. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our podcast. This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. New listeners, don't forget to follow us. You can find us across all of the main platforms, and you can connect with us on all of the social platforms. And if there's something that you think that you would like to hear us discussing in future, don't hesitate to get in touch. For now, it just leaves me to thank my guest, James Morris, Director of the CSBR Policy Centre. Thank you, James.
No problem.
Malcolm Moore, Chair of CNI Scotland. Thank you, Malcolm.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business.